If your brain is at full capacity with to-dos, birthdays, dinner plans, meet Skylight Calendar. It syncs your entire family's schedule onto a sleek digital display, so you focus on important things, like where you left your coffee. Right now, Skylight is offering our listeners $30 off their 15-inch calendars by going to skylightcal.com/talk. Go to skylightcal.com/talk for $30 off your 15-inch calendar. That's skylightcal.com/talk.
Memorial Day deals are here at Lowe's. Get up to 40% off select major appliances, including Samsung. Plus, save an extra $50 on every $500 you spend on select major appliances $396 or more, like the Samsung Bespoke French Door Refrigerator featuring Beverage Center and Dual Ice Maker. Shop at Lowe's today. We help you save. Valid 5/15 through 6/18. Selection varies by location. Total savings varies based on purchase amount. See Lowe's.com for details.
We're speaking 5 years after the death of George Floyd.
People were not interested in the truth. They were really interested in emotion. And all in all, it was going to end in an irrational kind of response, which it did. People wanted to say that Britain as a whole was systemically racist. The thing that people didn't want to talk about was human agency. This was kind of almost a sin. You cannot say that poor black people should be able to use their own efforts to forward themselves. They're incapable. That's almost the message from the left.
Hello, I'm Fraser Myers, Deputy Editor of Spiked. I'm absolutely thrilled to be joined by Lord Tony Sewell. Now, Tony, we're speaking 5 years after the death of George Floyd, which sparked the kind of globalisation of the Black Lives Matter movement. You were tasked by the British government at the time at looking into the various racial and ethnic disparities that still plague the UK. We can come on to that in a moment and some of your conclusions. But just looking back on 2020, do you think it's fair to say, did we lose our minds a little bit back then?
We lost everything, minds, everything, you know, everything went really. And probably looking, it's really interesting, you know, that along with COVID, people do lots of reflections now as to what happened there, you know, what was I, did I really do that? Did I really say that? Or did I really lock everybody up, you know? And and it's similar, I think, with the BLM stroke kind of global infection that happened after that. I think the mind loss or the kind of went was really driven, I think, by a couple of things. I was speaking to a lecturer, and she said to me that maybe for the first time, nobody had actually seen online in almost like a horrible snuff movie, you know, this thing in real life, you know, somebody dying at the hands of a policeman. What it did was, I think you got that visual thing, and then everybody had it on their phones, and there was that sense that there was, we've got to go out and we've got to do something. Where I think the mind loss came was, there wasn't any kind of connection between what was going on in your own country and your own space and your own reality and what happened in a very small town in America. You know, I mean, I don't know how many black people are in South Korea, you know, at the moment running, you know, and yet they had demonstrations, you know. It was kind of a strange kind of thing. So clearly something else was going on. And I think what it shows was the power, really, of that America, that Americana, that kind of civil rights power from Martin Luther King time to really kind of produce still in us that sense that of righteousness, and we've got to try and do something to help the underdog. I think that was, so that's there in that kind of, in and it's quite interesting that you have people who claim to be left wing, you know, and they're on the left, and yet at the same time driven by things that are in America, not from here, you know, which is another contradiction in a sense. But I think the other thing for me, just looking back on it, was that people were not interested in the truth.
Yeah.
They were not really interested in facts. They were really interested in emotion. And this was an emotive act, and so we had to do something emotively about it. Even to a certain extent, the government felt they just had to do something here. So I think all in all, it was going to end in an irrational kind of response, which it did. And I think what the outcome was that people wanted to say that Britain as a whole was systemically racist. They just wanted that to be said.
Yeah.
And that's almost, remember, we're dealing with religious things here. That's almost like part of the ritual.
Mm.
Once we'd commissioned a report, you say that, and then that's it. What surprised everybody, I think, in this sense, was that two things. For the first time, I think, in British history, we've had a report that the makeup of the commission was predominantly ethnic minority, one token white guy in there. That was really it, really. And so you had all groups, in a sense, in there, and looking at this disparity issue and me as a commissioner. That was one thing. And secondly, I think we dared say, we had the temerity to say that, you know, the white group was actually experiencing the worst racial disparity.
Yeah. And talking about some of those disparities, I mean, they do exist, but, you know, one of your main points was that these are not, racism is not necessarily the cause of them. You know, there are other factors leading to certain groups falling behind.
I mean, it surprised me that academics, intellectuals, well, it didn't, because obviously people are politically driven.
Mm.
But, you know, there were all different things that were coming up in there that drove disparities that were not necessarily anything to do with racism. I mean, for example, you've got things that would appear to be, in my own area, in education, for example. Mm. You know, you would see a disparity that looked like this was, this must be explained by racism, because you've got, African Caribbean groups that were performing poorly and excluded disproportionately. However, once we decided to get rid of a notion of BAME and the whole idea of one group, one block of ethnicity, and you broke it up, you began to see that, in fact, the opposite was going on. In fact, Indian Hindu backgrounds pupils and Nigerian pupils were doing much better than African Caribbean pupils. And then when we cut the cake even further, we looked at the reasons for that, and that couldn't be explained by racism, because when we looked at the Nigerian groups, they were in the same classrooms as the African Caribbean students. Mm. And then we that pushed us towards looking at other things. So we looked at family structure. We looked at other factors in there that could explain why there was that disparity. And on it went. Everything seemed on the surface to be normally sort of say, oh, that must be racism. There were other factors that were in play.
Yeah. And I think what was also great about the report, it wasn't just that you identified these disparities and disadvantages, but you were also able to point to some real successes in ethnic minority Britain. And it feels like that's often not talked about. There's doom and gloom from all sides, in a way, from left and right, about where we are as a country.
It was a happy report in a time when, and happy in the sense, I mean, it was sad for poor white working class, poor low income community. I think it was sad for them. But it was, and to a certain extent, maybe Caribbean group as well, but certainly for the new African group and certain Asian groups in education and employment, this was a positive story. The other positive things in some of the outcomes was the trajectory of race relations in Britain.
Mm.
It certainly marked an improvement. Whereas you talk to people and you would think that we're back to 1950s, 1960s, you know, the way people speak about it, when in fact all the indicators showed that things were improving. Yes, there were issues about segregation and things like that, but all in all, people were getting on with each other. And in fact, the outcomes for ethnic minorities couldn't have been better, particularly in terms of education.
Yeah, and some of the solutions that are often put forward to certain disparities, it'd be good to talk a bit about those. We often told that it's necessary to decolonize the curriculum, or that we need to see more black teachers in classrooms, or perhaps more black politicians or people in culture. I mean, what do you make of those kinds of arguments? Does that really work? Is that necessary, or is it a distraction?
Well, I worked in Hackney before I did this report, and that's one of the reasons why probably I was chosen. Where prior to that, and again, this was a Labour government instigated the kind of reform in Hackney, where it was deemed back in the 1990s as having the sort of the worst school district in Europe, not even in Britain, you know, and nobody wanted to be there or be in those schools. And we actually, and I worked there, we tried all of those, particularly the group that was performing the worst, which was the Caribbean group again, Black Caribbean. And we tried the black teachers, the black history, you know, we kept on all those kind of curriculum elements. And it just didn't shift at all the outcomes of those students. It was only when we really did a massive school improvement project in that school and talked about leadership and high expectations of students and really did be quite forensic about the outcomes of the area and of the students and of the pupils and parents getting involved as well, that the thing shifted and then Hackney flipped in over 3 years, became a model borough and instigated the academy movement. So you see, I think that there are real examples there of nothing to do with all those things that the activists want, which is decolonize the curriculum. I mean, we, Catley continued to teach Shakespeare, continued to do all those things that it normally did. It wasn't in that area that the problem we found. It was really to do with how the school was run and organized, you know, and also there's some other things I think that people are avoiding in this whole debate around race and education expectations and priorities. And you can see it from the groups that are doing well. I mean, I share an acronym with a friend of mine, Ian Rowe, in America, and we call it FREE, which is kind of family, religion, education, and enterprise. Mm. And those things around particular communities, once they've attached themselves to those things, they are the drivers towards success. So really, we were doing the thing that people didn't want to talk about, which was human agency.
Yeah.
The idea that communities can drive themselves. And there was not really anything institutional that was stopping anybody going forward via only your own energies. And this was kind of almost a sin, because we have to talk about this again in religious terms. You know, you cannot say that poor black people should be able to use their own efforts to forward themselves. They're incapable. That's almost the message from the left.
Yeah.
You know, and we said no. We've got evidence that can happen. And if you look at communities that are doing well in our society today, and they just happen to be Chinese, Indian, and Nigerian, those three communities are using that. They're not doing anything. They're not really engaging anything to do with decolonizing the curriculum or anything else that you want to think that would be anti-racist in the sense of that project.
Mm.
And I do think that sometimes some of those things are a hindrance. Listen, I mean, we've been misunderstood. There's a lot of misunderstanding around this whole report and everything. First of all, we did not deny in any way the existence of racism or institutional racism. That was obviously a ploy to use it to distract from what we wanted to say. We state that racism continues, it persists.
Mm.
However, even though it persists, it's not enough to stop, I think, the agency and the efforts of individuals and communities to do well. There are lots of Kemi Badenoch added some more outcomes for our report, but recommendations, we had about 50 odd, and so that would have acknowledged that there was a problem if we had to put recommendations in. But if you look at those recommendations, they're all pivoted around this whole idea of agency and getting people to empower themselves. But it's an acknowledgement there were structural issues that we have to deal with. But it's not as if Britain is in this sort of almost, I mean, you got a sense of that we're almost in some apartheid kind of regime, the way people were talking about the UK, and it was far from that.
Yeah, and of course we've recently had, you know, some quite appalling race riots last year. Do you think that have we taken a step backwards, or do you think that was more of a kind of one-off?
Are you talking about the Southport?
The Southport riots, yeah.
Yeah, I think, for example, the Southport thing, I think was quite specific. I think it would be, I always believe that you've got to be so careful with, it's the same thing with the BLM thing, with the one-off issues that happen. Just as you can, a black person watching this now will say, well, look, I've experienced a lived experience of racism on my way home or in my family. They can tell you about that. So it's not that these things don't exist, but what we were tasked with was to look at the overall picture, the data, numbers, the big picture story, rather than the individual incidents. I think the Southport thing was worrying for two reasons, and I think that my report does actually have some implications for it. I think that you can't excuse people who are basically arsonists who decide to go after people who are vulnerable. That is a criminal offence.
Yeah.
And you must condemn that. However, if you, not everybody was involved in that, and people had some serious, you know, kind of things that they felt, grievances that they had. And I think that here and in the US, what's happened is we just haven't listened to those left behind people, predominantly white, predominantly on our south coast and in the north, and we're just—I mean, every government just seems to ignore them. We didn't in the report. We just said, look, we're looking at disparities, and this group of people have some serious issues to address around housing, around education, around employment, you know, and in a sense, they often get condemned as just a bunch of racists. And so as far as we're concerned, that's wrong. Mm. It's not, so there's that issue. And then there's a specific Southport issue, which I think in its context, you know, one must be very careful with that because, you know, people were indulged in criminal activity. Others weren't. People were on their laptops. I think a lot of racism is on the social media, but I don't think necessarily people should be jailed for saying things, you know. So I think that whole thing did expose a number of issues that we deal with. But I think the particular underlying issue, which still hasn't been dealt with, is that you know, governments are not sharp enough on this because you ignore that group at your peril because they are the London will not decide the next election.
Yeah.
You know.
And just finally, what, you know, what direction do you see things going in America? There's talk of a sort of vibe shift. You've seen the end of sort of DEI schemes. A lot of this this kind of racial politics seems to be on the back foot, but where do you think Keir Starmer and the Labour government stand on this? Obviously they did famously take the knee during Black Lives Matter. There've been talk of a Race Equality Act, though we haven't seen anything that hasn't seemed to have come out in any real form. Where do you think this is going in the UK?
Let's be honest. Politicians will go where the wind blows. Mm. Yeah. We see this with the grooming gangs thing. You know, they'll wave to their constituency, condemn an activity one minute and then not say anything on the other. I mean, I hate to say, I mean, I'm free of sort of being the chair of a commission now, but I mean, in a sense, I can freely say that it's pretty cynical out there, you know. I really do think, I'm sorry to say, it's my opinion. And I think from any, even though I'm from a particular brand of politics, I think it's on all sides, there is this cynicism. And so I honestly, I'm not happy really with where we're going with things. And I think the electorate's just got to be a bit smarter, you know, I did like the way the Red Wall did play the two parties. I thought that was that was something that was good. That was good about people thinking their way through. But then Reform comes along, and you wonder whether that's another, you know, a group being played again. You know, we don't know. And I so my sense is that I'm fairly concerned about the way in which in the US and in the UK we kind of can be victims of political cynicism. But on the other hand, I do think that the left itself, and this is some advice for them, they tend to open up the chicken coop to allow the fox in, because in a way you condemn that group of people, and they've got nowhere else to go. You know, you make them into the a pariah. You make, and then that allows another group to come in and grab hold of them. So they've got to do some serious thinking. Identity politics really isn't working, and never really did work. You know, in the end, you know, it was something that was fashioned out of the 1960s, and it's just not really having any deep application. I think even for black groups as well, it's just not working. You know, so my sense is that you've got to speak to everybody. You've got to speak to all needs, and be more clean skinned in the way you're going forward. That's a bit of my idealism, but I don't know if that's going to work. But you can see it. You can see how this thing is being played out. So, you know, somebody who's written this report, I also feel quite strongly, and this is what I wanted to say on this program, was that I felt that my own government could have used my report as a mechanism to do leveling up much better. Because it wasn't about really race. It was about how you level up the whole country. We spoke about geography and social class and family structure. And they could have used it in a better way to kind of, you know, but I think they got scared again of race. Race comes along and everybody gets frightened. Mm. Everybody is scared of not being, you know, they don't want to be called a racist. And so they try on different ways to avoid, you know, the truth. So, yeah, and the report is still out there and it can be used. It can still be used as a tool push things forward. I am actually happy also that a lot of people have repented of their sins. You know, they were coming for me. I mean, I see this in the Labour group in the Lords as well. They secretly tell me, Tony, that was a good report, but don't tell the whips that. You know, and it's that kind of sense that the report was very reasonable. A lot of the people who knocked the report never read it.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
But hopefully, it can still change a few minds, push things forward for the future.
I think these reports are very dangerous, you know, because I just think that you'll never have again. It was a chance in a million, really, of something where I was left to do anything. No, I was not. People think I was manipulated, and we just read the numbers and said the truth. I read reports after this, and they all are going to tell you, even before, especially around race, even before the report is written, this organization is institutionally racist.
Yeah.
Before it's even written, you know they're going to say that. So you say, well, what's the point? You know. Whereas we really were open and we were allowed to do that. I don't know if I see that again. In some of the, I tell you, a place where I do see a lot of openness, and I would say that anyway, but House of Lords have some internal reports that we have with other, you know, joint reports with party other the other side, and they're very good, they're very scholarly, but they tend to get shelved a lot. But I think that journalists should look at those things because they're less ideological, you know, and they tend to run with the numbers and with the facts. And I'm kind of hopeful for those sort of things. So I think that's a space where you could get some. And of course, the work of Spike, we like your work. You know? Yeah,
brilliant. Well, Tony, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Sure. Thank you.